It's hit and miss. I mean, some things we did didn't work at all. We had this great idea of recruiting, like, the straight girlfriends of gay men. We're calling them GFOGs, Girlfriends of Gays. Despite the great acronym, we were completely unable to reach that population. So we've had to be really creative. It's definitely, like, a legitimate difficulty that I think lots of people have with RDS. All right, let me introduce Candace. Candace Daniel is a doctoral candidate in the Department of Clinical Psychology at the University of Wyoming. Her research interests include disease prevention, health behavior change, and harm reduction. She's applying now for a clinical internship and plans to pursue a research career in empirically based and clinically relevant research with disadvantaged populations.
Thank you. Thank you, Jennifer, for inviting us. We're really excited to be here. So this research is from an ongoing study as well. It's a subsample of 25 women, and I have no relationships to disclose, and I'm going to skip over this since Jennifer covered it thoroughly. So specifically, I'm talking about rural populations. Methamphetamine is the number one drug threat to the state of Wyoming, and the state is pretty unique. There's a population of just over 500,000 people, which means that there are only 5.2 people per square mile. One university serves the entire state. Currently, the oil and gas industry is booming, and shift work, you know, these people are working 12 to 14 hour days for 7 to 14 days a week in a row, or 7 to 14 days in a row. And we do see significant meth problems in that industry. Dense and overlapping social networks. Everybody knows everybody. And people have close ties to the community. Also limited availability of healthcare services. Usually there's only one pharmacy per town. They require IDs in order to get syringes. And the people who work in the pharmacies are also members of the community, neighbors, friends, family. Also, a few medical specialists. Many people have to travel out of the state to receive any special medical care. And there are a few drug treatment facilities. So given, you know, the unique, complex cultural, socioeconomic factors of Wyoming, we chose to look at this sample using the social ecological perspective, so women embedded in these different social networks. And so this is 25 women with a history of methamphetamine use. We really struggled getting active users. We don't have any outreach programs. We don't have any needle exchange programs. And so really getting into the community and making ourselves known, you know, we were able to do that through soup kitchens, but we don't have any place for homeless to be housed. And so we really struggled with getting active users. We do suspect that a handful of our women were currently using. However, they would not admit to it. Women completed quantitative as well as qualitative interviews, and we used qualitative data coding to code all of this. And if you have any questions, you can talk to me afterwards. So women ranged between 19 and 44. Most were Caucasian, and most were single. Employment varied, and most did not have any education higher than high school. Last methamphetamine use ranged from 1 month to 2 years. Four women were introduced during childhood, ages 7 to 12, 8 during adolescence, and 13, 18 and older. And 16 women in our sample injected methamphetamine as our primary method of use. About half were introduced by friends and male partners, and 13 women were introduced by family members. And women who were introduced to meth by their family members tended to start younger, 16 years of age versus 20. This is not statistically significant because we have very low power, but when we do look at the full sample, we suspect that we will find a statistical difference. The themes that emerged, so within the women who started using within their family networks, they started younger. They talked about trust, and I'll get into these in more detail, and their social networks predicted relapse among women who were introduced by their peer network, started methamphetamine use later, used within their social networks of friends and work, and these networks also predicted their relapse. Across all women, we saw significant sexual and injection risk behaviors, sharing syringes, unprotected sex, and finally, pregnancy was when all of our women were pregnant at one time, at least, and many of them stopped using while they were pregnant. So this graphic displays one woman's drug use patterns. And so the horizontal axis is her age, and above that is her methamphetamine use patterns. And the middle is psychosocial stress, and the top is a social network. And so this woman is a 23-year-old Hispanic woman, and she was actually introduced to methamphetamine use by her mother, and she was 12. And she was actually looking for her mom's pot and stumbled across methamphetamines. And so right after she started using it, her parents divorced, and she moved in with her mom's boyfriend. And she says, my mom got a boyfriend in another town, and we just moved in the middle of the night there. And that was when I was really introduced to meth. He was my mom's new boyfriend. The first time I walked into his house, there was just pieces of meth all over the tables and stuff like that. So it never occurred to me that it was bad, so I used all the time. Another woman talks about trust. This was her aunt and uncle. They made it okay. They made it seem okay because they were just occasional users. We were the same age. We were really close, and I figured since it was family, it would be safe. They wouldn't let me use too much or do too much. I think that's what made me comfortable, is it was my family, you know, I was safe. And finally, this girl was introduced by her older sister. She's my older sister, you know, she cared about me. There was nothing she was going to do to hurt me. And if she was doing it, it was okay. So this young woman, she actually, her social network became her mom and her mom's boyfriend's social network. She said, I met them through my mom's boyfriend. I mean, everybody knows everybody in this state, you know. My mom's boyfriend had some friends and I knew them. And then, like, I met some other people at school. And so she developed these friends. Her mom was imprisoned and she got pregnant and she stopped using. And then her mom was released and she started using again. After my mom got out of prison, she moved in with me. And, you know, at that point, I don't know, it just seemed so natural for me to be high all the time. When my mom was around, I didn't know, maybe that's stupid or whatever, but, you know, my mom was around and I started getting into it again. And her use increased before she finally stopped when we captured her. And with this woman, she stopped both times when she was pregnant at 15 and again at 18. And so this is an example of a 29-year-old woman who was introduced by members of her peer network. She actually grew up in a small town with only 7,000 people, and she talks about her small town. In my town, the cops were pretty cool. I mean, they were pretty lenient. They didn't bust our parties. They didn't pull us over. They didn't mess with us too much because it's a small town, and that's where you can get away with most of your shit. I mean, there were drugs coming in and out of that town so much, and with it being a small town, everybody knew everybody. Another woman said, once you meet, it's kind of like a chain. It seems like once you meet someone you know that sells it, it seems like they have a friend or they have a couple friends with them that come to deliver it or whatever, and that's how I met all these people. And another example of dense social networks. Being 15 there, not knowing anybody, I started meeting her friends, and everybody who did drugs did meth. So I would start selling it for them, taking it to high school. So this woman, she moved to a larger community, which had 20,000 people, and she got a job at a bar, and she started using every day. Her use increased. You know, she needed to stay up and work. And she was able to stop after that. But her friend was released from prison, and that's when she relapsed. One of my best friends of 10 years got out of prison, and he didn't have a place to live, so I opened my door to him. And at that time, I believed that he wasn't involved in the dope game anymore. Well, it was about a month after I bonded him out that I realized that he had been lying to me, and he wasn't really clean. I would go to the bar, get drunk, I'd go home. I'd start getting high because of the guy who lived with me. And then she relapsed again. And it's just something you can never go back to. And you can never associate yourself with those people. And once you knew that, do still continue to do that. The past 15 years, over 12 of my friends have been in and out of prison, and I've been there writing letters, putting money on their books, giving them a place to live, and when they get out, finding them a job and trying to save them. So she was there for her friends all the time, but they weren't staying clean, and so she tended to relapse when they were around. This woman actually was unable to live in one of the largest cities in Wyoming, because she knew so many people there that used methamphetamine that she wasn't able to live in that town. And this woman, again, she stopped when she got pregnant at 25. So just, the take-home messages, you know, these women are using methamphetamine within their family and social networks. We can't just treat women exclusively. We need to think larger, think structural, think community, think culture. Women don't live in vacuums. What we really want to do is teach them skills that they can cope with psychosocial stressors, give them social skills so that they can establish new ties, new social networks when they are in recovery, involve family in drug treatment. We need to get the family. We know that a large percentage of our population or our sample was introduced or to meth by their family members, and so we need to also include them. Perceptions of safety within these networks. We need to give them more access to syringes. Many assumed, it's my sister, I can't get anything from her. So they shared syringes. And they kind of assume a known partner is a safe partner. We need to dispel that. Finally, if we can get women while they're pregnant, and we can give them, you know, parenting classes, social skills training, coping strategies, maybe we can help them succeed in recovery. Thank you.
Questions back there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting because they referred to their aunts and uncles, cousins, as very close friends. Yeah.
Black.
Yep, we definitely think so. We know that the companies also do as well. They have institutionalized, like, mandatory drug testing because it's been such a big problem. But the people who are doing the testing also are using meth. And so I've heard several stories. We have a whole sample of men that we haven't been able to get to their data yet. But just anecdotally from men that I've spoken with, they say they were given a heads up when they had to get tested. They were actually buying meth from their boss. So.
One last question in the back corner.
Yeah, I'm just curious also about the age of the first is its relationship to an older person, specifically around sexual activity.
Mm-hmm.
I mean,
mm-hmm.
Somebody introduced them to the Sparta, and the drug itself is just a tremendous euphoria.
Yeah, that's interesting. What was very interesting is that we saw two ends of the spectrum. Some women who use meth wanted to have sex all the time. They described using meth as having an orgasm, and engaging in sexual activity on top of that was incredible. But then we have this other group of women who absolutely said, I was not interested in sex. I couldn't focus. I wanted to clean. I was doing all these different things. So we actually haven't looked at that pattern at who falls where yet, but that's a great question, and we definitely plan to look at it in the future.
Thank you. Great. Thank you.
Okay, Danielle German's going to speak next. She's been doing qualitative and quantitative work on a 5-year HIV intervention project among methamphetamine users in northern Thailand. Danielle is a doctorate candidate at Johns Hopkins School of Public Health. She's graduating this year. And her research focuses on drug use and HIV intervention strategies. Oh, let's get you going. Sorry about that.